Matthew is one of the two Gospels that has anything about the birth of Jesus. The other Gospel is Luke. And the two accounts are so different that one could guess, and probably with a lot of accuracy, that Matthew tells you pretty much what he's going to do and what his purpose is in those first two chapters, because so much of it is just totally unique to Matthew's and is not shared by the other Gospel. So just to refresh your memory, where you get... I guess you can use your Bibles if you want to, but try it from memory, just to see if we can get the outline of the Matthew story on here, okay? I'm going to put three columns on here, and we're going to I'll just ask you to think back and try to remember items in the story of Matthew, or items concerning Jesus' birth. We're going to either put them here, that they occur in Matthew alone, they occur in Matthew and Luke, or if they're just Luke's story and not the others. And we'll discuss a little bit why even bother to separate them. Okay, what happens in that, in those first two chapters in the story of Jesus' birth?
Genealogy.
Okay. Now that also occurs in Luke. So I'll put that here. Okay, but Matthew's is unique in a couple of respects. Okay, then, and that's the first thing that happens. That's the way the story starts out, the first 17 verses. Others.
Angel comes to Joseph and Matthew.
Okay. Okay, and Luke, it's an annunciation, but it's not to Joseph, it's to Mary. Okay, and that's really the next item in the story.
Right, okay.
Use that word that I think the IRSV translates it, wise men. The two are, I think the word is the Greek word is closer to this, so they're about equivalent statements. There's nothing in Luke about it. Okay? And that is in chronological or in textual order, everything so far is. Maybe some details in that story would help. Doesn't say how many there were. Later Christian tradition has, because there have been three gifts, there were three wise men. It doesn't say one, two. Well, it says at least two. I guess in certain places the interpretation has been up to a dozen wise men have come. There have been paintings of two, there have been paintings of four, and a dozen. Any details about that? I did say gifts.
Herod.
Mm-hmm. Good. Herod occurs in Luke, mm-hmm, just to designate a chronology, like a calendar. Totally impartial way. There's no judgment about if Herod is good or bad in Luke that I can recall. I'm just going to put him here. He's some sort of evil character.
Are you including under that the flight to Egypt and return and slaughter the innocents?
Flight to Egypt, the return, and... These are big verses. This occurs in the middle of the between the flight and the return. I guess I'll just change it for clarity. And that's where the end of the return is, where the second chapter ends. Okay. Now over in Luke, the things that they have in common here. Our visitation in Luke, it happens to be by shepherds. What other kind of things they have in common? Well, first, the story in Luke is the story. The first chapter is about the birth of John the Baptist. You know, Elizabeth, Zechariah, the Benedictus that Zechariah sings, the Magnificat that Mary sings. The first chapter is about that. The second chapter begins with the decree of Caesar Augustus. The journey from Nazareth to Bethlehem, the birth of Jesus, the visitation of the shepherds, and the shepherds go away, and Mary keeps these things pondering in her heart. And then taking Jesus to the temple for circumcision and for presentation. The points in common here, first of all, a genealogy that occurs, I guess, in chapter 3.
Luke?
Yeah. Okay. An annunciation, a visitation, in this case it was by shepherds. In this case it was the Magi. There's certain geographic information here, especially involving Nazareth and Bethlehem. Both stories talk about how Jesus is associated with both. Now, are there any other kind of connections between the two? No, the star is here. A parallel, you might say, would be the choir of angels, some sort of heavenly manifestation. And then I think we have to say the connection with Israel's history.
Does it ever indicate in either Matthew or Luke how they found all this out? Like, how do they know that Jesus was born in a manger and angels came and shepherds? Did Jesus tell them?
Okay, that's probably the next question. That's a really good one. The stories aren't alike. There are certain common characteristics, but you get the idea that the author of Luke had his own source of information, and the author of Matthew had his own source, and they didn't know about each other, and they didn't have the same information. So the question is, how did they have the information? How did they have these stories? And the possibilities, first of all, in looking at this, in looking at the stories, in doing biblical investigation, any questions fair. So with that, that the options would be, one, they made them up. Now that doesn't mean that it's a little more complex than that. It doesn't mean that they're just fabricating a story and they hoodwinked us and lied to them. They're all, you know, well, more about that later. Second, used used a pre-gospel story use many stories and put them together. Now that's sort of a combination of the two. Now, one particular view of things says that what happened was that Matthew sat down to write with a pen in his hand and became a dictaphone. You know, that wrote down exactly what the Holy Spirit said from beginning to end. Now, if we accept that, then there are a lot of questions we can't ask, and it's probably a good chance of it's ridiculous to look at the Gospels separately, to look at Matthew as separate from Luke. If given that idea that they were sort of automatons that wrote down the idea, it makes sense to take and make out of all four Gospels one big Gospel. And they have all the facts right there. And to let that be the authoritative, word-for-word story of Jesus' life. The fact that the church has decided not to do that and has left the four gospels independent with their points of view and with their particular audiences, with their particular concerns, like Matthew talks more about the kingdom of heaven, he quotes the Old Testament more, he talks about Jesus as the Son of God more than any of the others. If we're going to call that a unique concern to Matthew, then we have to eliminate the idea that it was without any kind of human input. And so we're left with one of these three, I think.
Or is it included in three word of mouth passed down from other people?
Okay.
Who lived in there and passed it.
Well, I think that word for that is oral tradition, right? Okay. All right, I'd say it was included in three.
Yeah, but it's a little, for us, it's a little different. It puts it in a different light to say oral tradition, because for us, use many stories that were floating around and put them together doesn't take cognizance of the fact that the only gospel was an oral gospel for many years, and that's the way teaching was, and that's what you did when you went to Hebrew school, was listen to stories and memorize. And I mean, mm-hmm. we tend to think of playing telephone at a party where at the end,
well, there's
it's
nothing
so
alive
far now from what the first person said when they whispered in your ear, whereas the oral tradition was a very careful way of continuing.
Okay, good point. Right, we tend to look at oral tradition with a little bit askance. There's good evidence to believe that no one saw the need to write down the stories about Jesus' life and work. And they circulated in oral tradition very carefully, very, very carefully preserved, because it was, well, the only way it could be preserved. Writing was not, you know, people didn't publish books and take minutes. So the concern, I guess, maybe we could make a statement. All originally were oral tradition. And when we say Matthew used many stories, the traditions that he heard as a Christian in his own particular church and situation, those stories maybe were connected together. And you can say that Matthew may have heard this all like this and reported it, just as he heard it. You could say also that Matthew heard the story without the Old Testament references, and he was one that added those references. There's some evidence that he added some, and that some were included in the story from the beginning.
Going back to Lois, we know that, for instance, at the death of Jesus, he asked John to take care of Mary, his mother, so she was still alive 33 years later. How long she was alive, we don't know, but apparently part of the inner group of disciples, so that no proof that the stories came, but she was an eyewitness to the earliest, right, and was still in the church. If you want to know how was it, when you think of going and asking Mary how it all came about, mm-hmm. She was still alive and in the worshiping community.
So she was maybe one of the most significant disciples.
Yeah, maybe one of the most significant in this oral tradition. There is another fact that I find very interesting. Maybe others have thought about it. That's the lack of any sort of information between Jesus' birth and the time he began his ministry. Mm-hmm. There is a little bit of information. And one of the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas supplies information, like when Jesus was 2 or 3 years old, he would make doves out of mud, throw them up in the air, and they would fly away, turn around and fly away. Of course, kind of violates the whole sense of the Gospels that we have in the canonical Gospels. But in the four Gospels we have, we don't have any stories, save the trip to Jerusalem in Luke, where Jesus got lost in the caravan and stayed behind and taught the elders in the temple. We have just no information. It indicates to me that when we look at those things, we've got to consider them just a little bit independently of that. That the sources for the story of Jesus' origin are going to be just a little bit different than the sources and the people that told the story about Jesus' life and work at 30 years of age. There's a big gap of years in there. So, I don't know, does that say anything? How are we doing? Is that making any sense? Any problems with the idea that we can look at Matthew and see, look to find what he was saying that, and not assume that it dovetails, at least not assume right away that it dovetails with everything that Luke says or that everything that else is going on in the Gospels? Does that seem like we're taking a chance there, or that we're kind of violating the sanctity of Scripture, or that the risks might not be worth the...
Well, if you take the four Gospels and let them speak for themselves, you'll also know that you're reading the heart of the story when you start backwards. You'll read the heart of the story when you understand his death. And less important, just how much time is spent and how careful with details, less important are the facts around his birth.
True.
The number of verses, the number of times, the weight of where the story has its climax, that Mark, the earliest gospel, doesn't even have any of this, that John has poetry, in the beginning was the Word, it starts into the story, so these sections are not unimportant, but they are what? How do you characterize something?
Well, they seem to be more of an avenue for speaking to the church that these people were in. They're using them. Well, you go ahead and say what you're...
I was going to say they're more important helping us understand who he was. Okay. And understanding the end of the story.
Yeah, it prepares us for the end.
Yeah, right. Okay. Right.
Yeah, it's interesting that in the beginning you can see a great difference between these Gospels. Luke starts out with those three canticles we sing, the Benedictus and the Dominus, talking about the elevation of the poor and the casting out of the rich. Matthew talks about Jesus' sonship, and we'll put that on the board right after this. Mark doesn't have any of it. John talks about the beginning of the Word. In the beginning was the Word. It talks about Jesus' identity, the I Am sort of statements and the signs. But when it gets to the entry into Jerusalem and the story of the Passion, they all kind of abandon their own separate things, and the story is incredibly alike. That the details are there, the story is told in essentially the same order, and it's an order that isn't apparent in the previous one. So what John said is right.
Isn't that just the difference between recording an eyewitness account and what somebody told you about what went on before you knew the person? How you hear can affect how you relate that.
Okay, and also the importance of the story. The fact that the death and resurrection was the most important fact about the life of Jesus probably indicates that it was remembered in greater detail, that the story was more important for the church, and as a result, more attention was paid to it.
But I also think the difference is just different people can see the same event and hear the same story and from their own experience write it in a very different way. The person sitting next to them saw the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that those differences just add a more fullness instead of being the confusion or seeing the contradiction. To me, it adds a more fullness.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, though, that their idea of adding a fullness is different from ours. I think we would tend, where they would see a complementariness in the various stories, and as Christians have, I think in our modern day and age, with our narrow conception of fact and truth and the kind of narrow definitions we give to that sort of thing, we tend more to see contradictions and to work harder at eliminating contradictions, whereas it wasn't a problem for people who, they had a little different sense of how they were complementary. Hopefully there'll be a few little illustrations when we talk about his purpose. I can think of one right now. Matthew's genealogy differs in a few significant places from Luke's. It can't be explained by saying Luke's was Mary's and Matthew's was Joseph's, because they both very explicitly say they're genealogies of Joseph. Now, we either say, well, one's true or the other. That's kind of our reaction. But the fact is, probably, the issue of whether one was true or not would not be as important as the fact that both genealogies connect Jesus to David and go back connecting to Abraham, and they make a significant point about that connection. Does the idea that they don't jive, or they don't say exact, like Jesus doesn't have the same grandfather in both of them, and it can't be explained by the practices of levirate marriage, it can't be explained by an additional name for the person. It's just, they aren't there the same. But we don't have to see that as a contradiction. We can see it as a pulse with a little bit of stretching in our minds. Huh? Yeah.
I think Lois has a good point. With Matthew, Mark, let's say Mark is the memoirs of Peter,
mm-hmm.
Either way, and John, if those three were called as apostles, disciples, and became part of the inner group, you would expect them to be able to write in more detail because they were eyewitnesses. Everything before he was 30 years old, they had to get in stories.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
Luke is a pretty good test of the point that I was making. There was somebody who wasn't an eyewitness. At least we don't know of him being an eyewitness to any of it, except maybe Paul's missionary journey some years later,
mm-hmm.
probably not Jewish. And he says when he writes to Theophilus, since there were lots of accounts, I have set about to write an orderly account, and he starts the conflict and the road to Jerusalem really in chapter 4.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely Luke 9:51 on is on the way to Jerusalem. So there you would have what I was saying, the selectivity of the important thing
mm-hmm.
being his death. Because he had all of the stories, was an eyewitness to none, and he
mm-hmm.
probably is a fairly good way in which we get the primary essence of the story, and I think it had to do with the crucified one.
Mm-hmm.
You see what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that's obviously not there in as much fullness in Mark is the story about what Jesus taught. It says
yeah.
over and over again that he did teach, but doesn't say what he said. Now that information came from another source of eyewitnesses, another source. Okay, I'm not sensing it.
If the interim class doesn't understand why you wouldn't get especially shook with some differences, then we've not understand living word yet. If truth is only propositional statements and you need an inerrant book in order to have faith, then we're in trouble.
Okay, is that still a problem pretty much?
I don't think it is. We didn't get any great fight this past week. But.
Okay. All right.
Is that right?
Or, we'll at least leave it an open question because there is a certain...
If it's the manger that holds Christ, we don't really worry about one crooked board or one bent nail if you're finding Christ there. Right?
That's right.
That's
but
the image we use. But
yeah. I think the historical question still remains.
Yeah.
If there was no Jesus, then if there was no resurrection, then we are of people most to be pitied. There is a certain, certain way that you just can't live on the story. And so I don't want to say, I'm not up here saying that the stories are fabrications. All I'm saying is that in doing the research and hearing anything new from the gospel, you got to be able to ask all the questions.
Yeah, but to say that it's a story, does it really make sense for 12, 15, 20, 30 people getting together and saying, let's create a story, and let's spread it all over the world, and how many are willing to give their life for it?
That's right.
30 people say yes, and they go out. I mean, it just doesn't...
It doesn't hold water.
Right.
No. Okay. Now I'm going to put... I'm going to make a statement, and hopefully, but Matthew is new to me. I didn't study it really closely in seminary, so I'm learning along with you. And I'm going to put something on the board as sort of a proposition to you, that Matthew is concerned in these two chapters about telling who Jesus is. And he does that, first of all, Right there in the first verse, what does he say?
The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham.
Son of David. Son of Abraham. And the stories culminate probably around the baptism of Jesus, and I think it develops up to a man, with Matthew's point that Jesus is the Son of God. Now I'm going to say that that is something that Matthew is concerned about showing initially in the origins of Jesus, because what's going to happen down here, and I'm just using kind of rough categories to help organize the complexities of what Matthew talks about there. And he describes him as the son of David in order to show his connection with the kingdom, the kingship, and the history of Israel. Okay? Son of Abraham, Abraham's great promise Abraham received, and the one that's always associated with Abraham is out of Genesis 12, where he is promised to be a blessing to the nations. Abraham has always got some connection with the Gentiles in the thinking of Hebrews. He was a Gentile. He was the first Jew, called from a Gentile to be the first person in the family of God. And the promise was that through him, all nations, all Gentiles of the world would be blessed. So Matthew calls Jesus the son of Abraham in order to show the inclusion of the Gentiles. Okay. And Matthew is concerned about showing that Jesus is the Son of God in order to demonstrate to the church that he belongs to and the church he's writing to demonstrate that statement that he makes as sort of a frame around the gospel. He says, one of the predictions, or one of the Old Testament quotes, the formula citations in Matthew, and this, the first two chapters, says, "And you will call his name Emmanuel," which means God with us, "for he will save his people from their sin." And also at the very end of the gospel, it says, "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you." It's a sort of frame. It's not, that isn't the main structural piece in Matthew, but it's sort of a frame around it. So when we look at those first two chapters, we're going to try it. Hopefully we're going to look at how Jesus, by what means does Jesus establish that, does Matthew establish that Jesus is the son of David, son of Abraham, and son of God? And according to one author, Raymond Brown has written this humongous book on just the stories of the infant Jesus in Matthew and Luke. The two chapters are fraught with information, fraught with means about how Matthew uses those stories to make this point. And then these, after establishing that, this flows through us flows through the rest of the gospel. I think I probably simplified things a little bit more, but that's the way I've gotten a handle on. Any questions?
Go through that once more. The son of David, son of Abraham, son of God. Yeah. Is basically the first two chapters.
Yeah, establishing the means. Matthew spells out the means by which Jesus is called. Well, he establishes means. Let me say that again. The story is about the way Jesus is designated son of David, what means prove that, demonstrate that. For instance, being born of Joseph, the adopted son of Joseph, who was the son of David. In order that those things being well established in the first two or three chapters, that the statements that follow from them, the preaching, the authority, the ministry of Jesus that follows from it, will be on a firm foundation. Is that any questions?
On Son of God, are you taking that specifically as a phrase used in the first two chapters somewhere? I mean, I noticed that, like in chapter 1, verse 1, the genealogy of Jesus Christ, Son of David, Son of Abraham. And I just haven't reread the first couple chapters of Matthew to see if that specific phrase is used.
All right, I think, suspect that Matthew is kind of a suspense that builds right up to the baptism, when the voice comes out of heaven and says, "This is my beloved son." And Matthew uses the word "son of God" in places that the other gospel writers don't use it. When the centurion sees Jesus die, Luke says, "Surely this man was innocent." Mark, I think, says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Matthew uses the Son of God. He says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Peter's confession in Mark and Luke refer mainly to the anointed, the Christ of God. Peter confesses it in Matthew by saying, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Rather expanded sort of formula. The confessions that that the disciples make when they're in sort of a more intimate circle with Jesus are confessions about Jesus being the Son of God.
So like by saying Jesus Christ, the Son of David, Jesus the Anointed, that would be more in the Davidic sense of...
Yeah, that's a good point. The idea of anointed... We tend with our incarnational model to think the word Messiah, the Christ, refers to this. And for the hearers, the idea of being anointed was associated with being a son of David, you know, an heir, the king that would come and sit on David's throne. Probably at the time Matthew was writing in heaven, it maybe had both meanings, but initially it was this. And I think Matthew is just trying to build up a little suspense in the story. And then finally at the baptism, when he's baptized, anointed, the Spirit comes down, the voice comes out of heaven and says, "This is my son." I suppose that point could be argued, but I think it's there. Okay. Well, now open your books and we'll try to see if we can find some of the means by which Matthew declares Jesus to be the Son of David.
Is there some significance to why the generations were quoted at 14? They go from Abraham to David, and then from David to the deportation of Babylon. Mm-hmm. How do they do that?
I don't know, except that that's totally foreign in my way of thinking. But I've read, and people have said that the Jews of the synagogue time found a lot of significance in numerology, or the way things occurred in numbers, you know, like the number 7, the number 12, the repetition of certain numbers. And it may have something to do, the idea of finishing that genealogy, which is mainly a discussion of these two, by finishing it with the talk about sort of the divine coincidence that there are 14 generations here, 14 and 14, may give an indication of some sort of divine arrangement